unidentified flying object.
Researcher on a mission with Dr. J. Andy Elias.
Welcome back to another episode of Dr. J Radio Live. Of course, I am your host, Dr. J, and co-hosting with me live in London is my good friend, Johnny Webb. Johnny?
Good evening to you, Dr. J. How are you, sir?
I am doing great, and I hope everybody out there listening is doing great, because today we have another superstar guest for you, someone who I know you've all heard before, and you will again hear in the future on Art Bell's show, as well as seeing him on the every lecture he's done, because this is a name that is so important to ufology that really resonates ufology when you hear about it. And you'll hear so much when I introduce him in literally just 1 minute. Let me quickly give you some UFO news, again, brought to you by the listeners. And of course, we always welcome them. And if you want us to give you credit for them, by all means, say so. The first one: UFO videos over Lake Tahoe, small white orbs. Now, this again goes to my question that I asked you last week. What is it about the natural resources that these objects seem attracted to? From lakes to rivers to volcanoes, even tornadoes, there seem to be spotted nearby observing. That is something that always has interested me for a long time. Earthquakes too. Another piece: UFOs in Illinois seem to be a hot spot. The actual title of the sighting is, "Why is Illinois a hotbed of UFO sightings?" Is it a new rash of sightings? Is something going on there now similar to the other waves that have gone in other states? I'd really like to know what your opinion and all that. And I know our guests can talk about that and so much more. The final piece of UFO news is, this was interesting. A Dutch photographer caught a jellyfish UFO on video. It's available on the net. All you have to do is Google Dutch jellyfish UFO and take a look at it. See what you think. I mean, again, we can only speculate, but these are all fantastic. The final thing I'm going to leave you with is, you heard this on Tuesday's show with Nassim Haramein, Contact in the Desert. I would love to get your feedback from it. I asked you guys on Tuesday. You guys have written me news. You've written me you had a good time, but no one wrote anything specific that you wanted me to read on air. So by all means, before next Tuesday's show with David Sarita, please do so. Go on to drjradiolive.com, hit the contact button, and write whatever you want to say, your best experience, your worst experience, and anything else you'd like to say. Okay, with that being said, now let's bring on our superstar guest, someone who's been contributing to ufology for a very, very long time, literally investigating his first case in 1964, I believe, 64, 19, or 65, 50 years to the year he's been investigating, 61 years to the year where he saw his first sighting, and then 21 years to the year of when he founded the National UFO Reporting Center, NUFORC. And that happens to be the one and only Mr. Peter Davenport. Mr. Davenport, welcome to the show.
Thank you very much, Dr. J and Johnny in the UK. It's delightful to be here. I'm looking forward immensely to this program. Really pleased to be here and have a lot of really interesting data, interesting cases that I'm looking forward to sharing with our audience tonight.
And that's exactly why I've had you on the list for quite some time to get you. And we've been working on this for several weeks, and I'm so glad I was able to get you on a live show, and it worked out perfectly tonight. And before we, first I'm going to go back in time to what originally kicked off your sighting, but then obviously at some point I'm going to give you the hint on what we spoke about just before we went on air, something that you created, which I think will really resonate with the audience. But before we go there, take us back to St. Louis, 1954. What happened?
Yeah, it's a night that I remember as clearly right now in the year 2015 as I think I remembered the day after this event occurred. It's something that was imprinted indelibly on my memory, and it was a shocking experience. Even though I was only about 6.5 years of age at the time, I realized how momentous an event this was. I was at a drive-in theater on the south side of St. Louis Airport. I was born and raised in St. Louis, interestingly in the now famous city of Ferguson, Missouri. And my father worked at the airport at Lambert Field. One night he had to work in the evening, and my family drove to the airport. We dropped my father off to work on the north side near McDonnell Aircraft Corporation. And my mother, my older brother, and I went around the airport to the drive-in theater, and we were watching a movie. Suddenly, a disturbance started brewing in the theater, and we didn't know initially. I remember thinking consciously to myself, what is this disturbance that is taking place? Is somebody injured, or is there a fire, or some kind of altercation taking place? I just didn't know. Suddenly, people started walking in our car, in front of our car, and it sort of annoyed me because they were blocking the screen, as I remember, and they were looking up to my right. So I glanced out the right side of the vehicle my family was sitting in and watching the movie from, and there was an object, its apparent size approximately equal to that of a full moon. So a very, very prominent object, and it was the color of a red traffic signal. Distinctly, I would call it fire engine red, with a little flavor of orange to it. And that object hovered in the night sky. I watched it. I was entranced by this object. And apparently so were the other people in the theater, because they were ignoring the movie. They were walking towards it and yelling and shouting and pointing at it. Suddenly, it accelerated from my right to left as I faced it out the right-hand side of the car, and it covered about 120 degrees of arc and disappeared over the horizon to the northwest of me in about 2 to 3 seconds. It accelerated like a marble being shot out of a slingshot. It was the most amazing thing I think I've ever seen in my life. What it was, we have no idea. Interestingly, my father and the air traffic controllers across the airport from us were also watching it with binoculars. They didn't know what it was either. When we picked up my father, it was all we could talk about as we drove home was what was that thing that we just saw. Very, very dramatic sighting, seen by hundreds, possibly even thousands of people.
One thing we all have to remember is, especially in 1954, a helicopter, which was recently invented, I don't think they were in service during World War II. It was post-World War II, before the Vietnam War. But obviously, they're very loud. So for you to have some object that is hovering, the only thing equivalent that we had at the time would have been a helicopter, but yet it would have made noise. Secondly, the thing you said, the way it disappeared is what fascinates me the most, because that goes against what our laws of physics currently say. You cannot go from 0 to 1,000 miles an hour without having some sort of acceleration to that point. And so obviously that brings the question of what a lot of the skeptics say, well, we can't go faster than light speed, or we can't travel in such a direction. But yet when you see something doing this, and that violates our known laws of physics, obviously, you know, they're doing something that we can't do. And as weird as it may sound to all the people out there who are looking at normal physics, just because we can't do it doesn't mean something else can't, because hundreds of years ago, things that we thought were not possible are clearly possible.
Absolutely. It was a very dramatic sighting. And as I mentioned before I started that description, it is vividly clear in my memory what all of that looked like. One of the points I failed to make as I was describing it is when it accelerated, it covered a sigmoid-shaped path across the sky. It wasn't a straight line. It was like an S-shaped line across the sky, and very, very dramatic sighting. And that probably explains why I, 61 years later, am the director of the National UFO Reporting Center. I've been interested in UFOs all my life. And that was probably the seminal event that triggered that interest.
that sent you out onto the course of gathering data, gathering sightings, and of course, investigating. Now, 11 years later, from 54 to 65, you investigated your first case in New Exeter, correct?
In Exeter, New Hampshire, that's correct. What turned out to be a very dramatic case, very well known in the field of ufology. It's called the Incident at Exeter, although it's a bit of a misnomer because, technically speaking, the sighting actually occurred in the New Hampshire city of Kensington, but they're adjacent cities, and that's the way things happen. But I had graduated from high school in 1965, and I was working for our local town newspaper, the Derry News. That's D-E-R-R-Y for our listeners, and not D-A-I-R-Y, the Derry, New Hampshire News. And for some reason, the editor and I, that summer of 1965 again, had debated UFOs. He was a total skeptic. He said, this is all nonsense, as so many people believe. Well, on the 3rd of September, 1965, a disc-shaped object chased a woman in a car. Then it chased a hitchhiker along a very remote rural roadside or roadway in New Hampshire. And then it showed itself before two police officers and that same hitchhiker who had seen it earlier in the evening. It was a very dramatic sighting, and John G. Fuller, who was a Boston columnist at the time, wrote a book on the subject entitled The Incident at Exeter. And in September of that year, I wrote a two-part article for the Derry News about my investigation of it. Really, I interviewed the two police officers, very, very reliable gentlemen. I interviewed the hitchhiker over the telephone, Norman Muscarello, 18-year-old fellow about to go into the U.S. Navy, and he was still upset by what had happened to him when I talked to him. Very interesting case, and I feel privileged to this day, 50 years later, to have been part of the investigation of that case.
Now, you investigated that in 65. And then, of course, in 94, you start the National UFO Reporting Center. But before that, you had already had other sightings in early 90s, I believe 90, 92, correct me if I'm wrong. But I'm assuming that you were still investigating after 64 to the present. And
well, not that much, actually. Excuse me for interrupting, Dr. J, but a couple things I'd like to set straight. Not technically, I was not the founder of the National UFO Reporting Center. That is credited to Mr. Robert J. Gribble, a retired fireman in Seattle, who in 1974 reasoned that what we needed in the field of ufology, he was very interested in ufology, and he argued that what we needed was one telephone number nationally, where if a person were to witness a UFO, he could call that number where the information would be collected, it would be preserved, and it would be made available publicly. I took over from Mr. Gribble in August of 1994, 20 years after he had started it. And I think he had gotten tired of running it. He worked very, very hard at it, as have I. And I can easily understand how a person would get very tired of this this routine of dealing with the public and taking UFO reports. But it was he, not I, who had founded it almost 41 years ago now.
And your tenure as the director has actually been longer than Mr. Gribble's, because he was 20 years, yours is 21 years and going.
Yeah, that's correct. I think I have probably handled more cases than he has, but let it be said, in all fairness and honesty, let it be said that the internet and modern telephone system and so on and so forth has made our jobs much easier than it was 41 years ago. Because back then, of course, all the information had to be taken over the telephone. People would, I presume, he would ask them to submit written reports after, as he was talking to them over the telephone. But he must have worked very, very hard at it. And I am not in the least surprised that after 20 years of it, he was ready to hang up his spurs and move on to other things.
And in the 70s and 80s, if you were lucky enough to have a camcorder and were able to capture something anomalous on video, obviously it was far more difficult to get that video to you now than it is now, where now someone can capture it digitally on a smartphone, for instance, upload it to unlisted channel or unlisted link on YouTube and send it to you before it's public, or vice versa. They could upload it to YouTube as public and send it to you while retaining the original. So I think the transformation of how people get you the actual sightings and the reports of, like you said, now before, where Mr. Gibble required them to be handwritten and sent, which is obviously that's what we had. We had no internet at the time. But now, as you mentioned, the internet has played a great role in bringing the community together that much more and making it that much easier to transfer data. Now, would you attribute the fact that we have more sightings to the fact that there's more communication amongst the world as a unified planet, in the sense that we do have the internet and have the ability to speak to anyone at will, almost even in third world countries, as long as they have an internet connection and some sort of computer? And these days there's fairly cheap computers that you could use in third world countries for Skype. And so I would imagine that you're getting a lot more now at a higher rate than ever, as during the 74 to 94 period before your predecessor ran it. Would you agree?
Well, I think you've answered your question.
Yes.
Yeah, absolutely. I think that's the case. And I think it's important also to mention people like Art Bell and the influence they had on the field, for having frequent guests like me and actual witnesses and other UFO investigators on his program to talk about some of our better cases. And I think it has opened the door widely to having people submit their reports if they believe they've seen something very unusual. So he played an incredible role, and there were other hosts as well, but none as big, with as big a program as Art had, who was very generous with his time towards us investigators. I remember in particular, on a couple occasions, I had the opportunity to call him literally minutes before his program, tell him about a very dramatic report that had come in just a few minutes earlier, and he would listen to it and say, let's go with it. And so we could have very dramatic UFO events being discussed, in some cases with the actual eyewitnesses involved, in a matter of minutes after the event had occurred. And that makes for really very dramatic and very interesting radio, in my opinion.
I'm really glad you mentioned Art for a couple of reasons. First of all, it's no secret. Everyone knows he's coming back July 20th to this network. He'll be on literally as this show ends. And I'm going to say this publicly. Mr. Davenport, assuming he accepts, which I hope you do, will be on the show, on Art's show, when he's back. Of course, we'll figure out a date when it gets closer. And before we went on air, the associate producer, Danny, has been helping out, actually brought up a very good topic of one of the shows that you brought up, that you mentioned when you did the Art Bell show. And that happens to be, and I'm going to change, we'll go back to the sightings that you had in the 90s after this, but I figure this is a good time to bring this up. You created something that I think is really, really important, far different than what is sold as gadgets at a lot of these UFO conventions or magazines. And that was a high frequency fence to detect UFOs and anomalous activities. And I was going to ask you, where did you get the idea for it? And then you made a comment prior to us going on air that you received acknowledgement from someone very high up that you were absolutely on the right track.
Yeah, well, thank you very much, Dr. J, for mentioning that, and I'm delighted to talk about my proposal for detecting UFOs because, in my opinion, and I'd like to say in my humble opinion, I think it is the next step in ufology is the ability to detect a UFO, and I think we can do it out to the distance of the orbit of the of Earth's moon. That's about 230 or 240,000 miles above the surface of our planet. We can detect the presence of UFOs unambiguously using a technology that is generally alluded to as passive radar. And what it means, the reason it's called passive is because it does not generate its own transmitted signal. Rather, what it does is it allows a person to capitalize on the radiated signals from powerful radio and television antennas, and that radio signal goes out into space unless there is something up above which would serve to reflect that signal back down to the ground. The brief and short version, or short and simple version, I should say, of a description of how it works is we can now, because of the advent of computers and because of the GPS system that gives us a very accurate time clock, we can build a system that allows us to listen for those reflected signals and then analyze them very, excuse me, very precisely to then be able to calculate where the reflecting object is and what its velocity is. All of that information tells us that we can detect the presence of a UFO, and we can also calculate its velocity without radiating a single signal from our system, from our listening post. The interesting thing about this, I was invited for the first time to speak at the July 2004 MUFON Symposium held in Denver by John Schussler, who was the international director of MUFON back then. He invited me in December of 2003. I was delighted to get the invitation, and I decided that I wanted to do something really radical, something that would really make waves in the UFO community, and I decided that this was the subject to present. So I wrote a paper. It's a 16-page paper. It's available from our homepage at ufocenter.com. It's been there for about 11 years now. I wrote a paper, and I sent it to MUFON in preparation for their publication of the proceedings of that symposium. Well, they put my paper on their website on the 6th of July, 2004, and to my great amazement, that afternoon, about 2 o'clock in the afternoon, I received a telephone call from a gentleman who identified himself as a senior officer at the Central Intelligence Agency in Washington, D.C., and indeed he is. He's very well known to the UFO community, and it was not very difficult to identify him over the Internet. Well, we had a very nice conversation, and he said at the conclusion of it, he said, "Mr. Davenport, if you build the system that you describe in your paper, you will be successful in answering the question of whether UFOs are real or not." He did not say that you would detect or we would detect UFOs. He said, "You will be successful in answering the question of whether they are real or not." So he was protecting himself, I presume. Had he said, "You will detect UFOs," it might have had him violating a secrecy oath in his role as a CIA officer. But I've talked to him several times since that conversation, and he is very encouraging. maybe this is something we could get funded through Art Bell's program when he comes back, get a system built, and that will take us to a new level, altogether new level of ufology.
I think that is a very fantastic idea, and I think the fact that you were acknowledged by someone in the agency is really the creme de la creme, because a lot of people speculate that, of course, there's different groups that are in charge of covering this up, but a lot of people point to the CIA and the directors of the CIA as being people that know things. And this is why a lot of people speculate that most of the recent presidents don't know, save George Herbert Walker Bush, because he was a member, or he was the director of the CIA, I believe 78 to 79 or 79 to 80. Nonetheless, I think that would have put him in a perfect position. Now, when this person, this officer, reached out to you, even though he was careful in what he said, I think just by him reaching out and confirming that you were on the right path is probably one of the best things that you can have happen, because I think he's still taking a risk by doing it, A, and B, what else could you ask for in as a ufologist, as someone who's researching this?
Yeah. Well, a couple things I left out that I would like to add. This gentleman has a PhD in physics. And during our first conversation, again, this was on the 6th of July, 2004, just before I left for the MUFON symposium, he said that during the first roughly 10 or 20 years, I've forgotten which, but a substantial period of time, his first responsibility as an employee for the Central Intelligence Agency was to build passive radar systems for clandestine, that is, undetected, detecting of targets. And so he was a specialist in this field, and I think that's part of the reason that my paper caught his eye. Actually, he told me at the outset of the program, or outset, rather, of our conversation, that the reason he was calling me is that a retired colleague of his from the CIA had seen my paper the day it was posted to the MUFON website and had sent him a copy of the abstract of my article, and it caught his attention immediately. I think he realized at that moment that ufology had suddenly grown up. Suddenly, people like me will be able to detect the presence of UFOs and certify, by collecting data about them, certify that they are UFOs and not commercial airliners or satellites or something along those lines.
Yes, and that's a very important thing, because so many people, when they make a report and they're not trained observers, as the skeptics like to coin that term, of course, you would imagine, and it's just data shows this, that more than 90%, maybe even more than 95% of what people actually observe in the sky is something explainable, whether it be a weather anomaly, an astronomical anomaly, or a military test jet. For instance, when the stealth fighter and stealth bomber was being tested, a lot of people thought the shape of it was something that resembled what other things were flying over cities in slow modes, which begs the question, of course, was our stealth and other objects that were wing-shaped copied from what we've seen in the stars? But regardless, going back to the original point you made, to be able to differentiate between all of this is something that is absolutely needed in this field. What's it going to take for us to get the system up and running? Do you have an idea of the figures?
I do. And we have an engineering team, consists of 4 electrical engineers and computer experts. And that team estimates that it would cost about $750,000 to build a prototype. They further estimate that if we can find somebody who has access to a relatively large group of programmers, computer programmers, that would drop to probably a third of that figure. So as low as $250,000, it sounds like a lot of money, but 90% of the system, 90% of the cost of building that prototype is for the cost of programming. It takes a great deal of very intricate computer programming to be able to calculate or to be able to analyze and calculate from the reflected signals what is reflecting that signal, where it is, how fast it is moving, what direction it's going, and so on. But all of that information can be extracted from the reflected signal, and depending on the level of the noise, the power of the signal, and other factors as well, we estimate that in some circumstances, we may be able to reach out 250,000 miles from Earth. And once you've gotten the reflected signal, of course, you can process it very quickly, and you can put that information on a website. It would allow a person to sit in his overstuffed chair or on his comfortable divan and look at the screen of his computer and see UFOs coursing above the surface of the planet Earth. As you probably can tell, I'm very excited about this. It's the greatest academic contribution that I believe I've ever made, one of two only. And I am very keen on building the first system. I suspect that the government is going to be very uncomfortable once that they know that that system is in place, but they will have very little to say about it because the system does not broadcast a signal. I wish to emphasize that point. It only sits and listens for a reflected signal from space.
Well, I would actually have to say you've done a lot academically. First of all, getting a certificate in translating Russian, as well as I believe you double majored in biology and Russian from Stanford before you went off to do graduate work. You've done a whole lot with your life. I think this is just one of the greater achievements for ufology. I think you're being more humble, but you know that just makes you that much more respectable. But you are truly held in high regard to everybody here involved in this program, as well as listeners as well. Now, I want to ask you, the financing that we're talking about, do you have anything set up where people can donate right now? Or have you thought about maybe starting a crowdfunding, or do you want to wait until after?
Many people have recommended that, but I hesitate to do that because I used to work in the venture investment or venture capital industry. This was about 25 or 30 years ago, and my experience has been raising money piecemeal like that is a very difficult prospect. It is better to find one person and have a serious-minded sit-down meeting, explain what we're proposing, explain how much money we need, how it will be spent, and so on and so forth. That just happens to be my particular predisposition with regard to fundraising. The one thing you don't want to do is start fundraising and then have it sputter and stop, because then you risk all sorts of complications that you really don't want to have to deal with, some of them legal, actually. You don't want to raise money or represent that you can do such and such a project and then fall short on the funding, and then you have to return all that money, of course.
Yes.
So
yes.
I have a fairly strong bias with regard to fundraising. Maybe crowdfunding would do it, but I'm not very skilled with computers and the Internet, and so it's just something that I think I would try to avoid.
Well, whenever you're ready, you let us know. Just as you were answering this question, I got three questions relating to it, but you sort of answered them. But I'm just going to do this listener an honor and just read them. This is from Peter from New York. It's three in a row. Does Mr. Davenport have financing? Is he looking for contributors? And is there going to come a time when individuals are able to get involved? And not with crowdfunding, no returns, we will do it. That was the final statement. But again, you sort of touched on that.
Yeah.
What was your... Go on.
Go ahead, Dr. J.
Oh, I was going to say, what was your inspiration to finally realize that that's the proper way for us to get there, to detect them?
It's sort of a humorous, if you enjoy that story, I would like to tell it, because I can almost tell you the moment when I had the epiphany, the awakening, that told me what I should do and how I could do it. As I mentioned just a few minutes ago, I used to work in the venture investment industry. And one of the companies that had come to our company looking for funding, capital infusion, was a company called Meteor Communications Corporation in Kent, Washington. They make very interesting communications technology that allows them to reflect a radio signal off the ionized trail behind a meteor. When a meteor flies into the Earth's atmosphere, because of the friction with the gases in our atmosphere, the meteor heats up. That's why you can see them, of course, why they glow so brightly, albeit for a very short period of time in most cases. Well, you can bounce a radio signal off ionized gas. It serves as a reflection point. So when a meteor flies into the atmosphere, you have 2 or 3 seconds, during which time you can beam a radio signal at its tail or at the trail behind it, and that radio signal will then be reflected further on from that trail of ionized gas very high in the atmosphere. So in other words, you can skip a radio signal about 1,200 or 1,500 miles away. Well, I believe it was on Friday in late January 1995, I had panicked. Panicked for the following reason. When I took over the job of being director of the National UFO Reporting Center, that was in late August of 1994, I assumed that that job would amount to taking maybe 2 or 3 or 4 telephone calls per week. And before I knew it, I was taking 1, 2, or 3 dozen telephone calls per day. So I, like the young lad, the Dutch boy who took his finger out of the dike, I had initiated a flood of telephone calls. And I had no means to finance this, and it was just I who was doing this by himself. Well, in late January, I think it was Friday, about the 25th or 26th of January, 1995, I was ruminating on how I could somehow get away from the telephone, how we could somehow detect UFOs through some means other than eyewitnesses, many of whom, as you pointed out earlier, are not trained to be professional eyewitnesses. They don't, in many cases, they're not familiar with a lot of the principles involved in the sightings that they have. So it makes it difficult for them to report very precisely what it was they saw. Well, then I suddenly realized, as I ruminated on how we could get away from eyewitnesses, that we could use the very same technology for detecting UFOs that Meteor Communications Corporation in the Seattle area used for detecting the meteors in the Earth's atmosphere. That was a moment that it was one of the happiest times in my life. I said, Eureka! That is the way we detect UFOs, is by detecting the signals that are reflected from them from commercial radio and television stations. And some of those stations, as you know, are very powerful. We are probably talking over stations that radiate 50 or 100,000 watts. That's a lot of radio energy, radio power, I should say. So that was when my awakening occurred, and it was later, that was January of 1995, I wrote an article for the UFO Journal and thought that it was going to be welcomed with open arms. In point of fact, it was about 3 months before I even received a response to my article. I was talking about the use of what is called passive radar for detecting UFOs. I thought the UFO community was going to rally around the idea and help finance it, help build it, and it would be the end of things like UFO hotlines. We wouldn't have to man them anymore. We could just detect the UFOs directly. But in point of fact, that didn't happen. And even after my presentation in Denver in July of 2004, it did not happen either. Only one or two people commented on my presentation. And here I am presenting the use of an existing technology that would allow us directly to detect UFOs, and it did not create the stir that I hoped it would. So I'm still in, I'm sort of locked in the irons, as a sailor would say, and not able to move forward until we get funding. Once we have funding in place, we can build this system, and I'm sure it will work because there are many passive radar systems that are already working on this planet.
Well, fortunately, now we have a lot of big players that have money that would normally have never spoken about this that are finally coming out. For instance, Jack Osborne, son of Ozzy Osborne, has appeared on this show. And of course, we know he comes from money. Sean Stone, Oliver Stone's son. Hopefully one of them will step forward. And if not, I believe the listeners out there, because just by you bringing this up is huge. Let me read you one other question, comment, and this is from Stavros in Chicago, Illinois. Can individuals contribute to the project with computer resources, hardware, or is this all going to be done in-house? And if so, how can they get a hold of you?
Yeah, well, anybody can reach me either by calling me on the UFO hotline. We've had the same number for 41 years, simply 206, the area code for Seattle, 206-722-3000. Please don't call during this program, of course, because I'm busy. That's one way they can reach me. They can also send me an email. My email address is on our website. The website is ufocenter.com. We've got about 96 or 97,000 reports posted there. If people haven't read some of those reports, I'd like to urge them to do so, and I hope we can talk about some of them here later in the program. But they can send me an email. My email address is director@ufocenter.com. They can reach me from anywhere in the world.
And actually, when we return from the break, I will reiterate this information again. I want everybody out there listening to have another chance to write this down. And of course, I will post this when this show is archived. We will absolutely talk about some of those super important cases. I just want to turn the question around slightly with regard to what you said. Since we've been using this existing technology already, do you think the fact that we've been broadcasting radio waves for 80 plus years now, I know it was happening in the 30s, maybe it was even in the 20s, has contributed to more objects or more visitors paying attention to our planet, whereas opposed to several hundred years ago or a few thousand years ago, they just knew we're a primitive planet?
Yeah. Well, that's an interesting proposal, and I tend to agree with your suspicion that our intelligent radiated radio and television signals, the radio has been going out for probably about 100 years now, maybe a little bit more, 110 years. Anybody who is listening, who has very sensitive receivers, would have quickly recognized that there was a change near our star, a change in the electromagnetic radiation from our planet. Of course, they could have detected lightning bolts. They give off radio waves. That's why there's interference on an AM radio during a lightning storm. But they would have seen a change in the intelligent nature of these electromagnetic emanations from this planet. And I agree with you. If there's anybody within 100 or 110 light years who is listening to electromagnetic radiation, they would have quickly realized that there's intelligent life that has a relatively high degree of technological understanding, at least with regard to their ability to use electromagnetic radiation for communications purposes. It's interesting to consider the possibility that people or creatures out there in our galaxy are listening to or looking at Twilight Zone or listening to the Marx Brothers humor. Might be very difficult for somebody to interpret what all of this means. But yeah, I agree with you. That's certainly a real possibility. And also, Stephen Hawking made the point that we may not want to be doing that, because that puts us on somebody else's radar, and they might, it might induce them to come and want to look at what's going on this planet.
Absolutely. I actually want to make a comment about that. I do have one question. I presume actually I know the answer since you've sort of hinted this, but I got to do the listener the honor of reading it anyway. This comes from Ricky in Medford, Oregon. Can you track the UFOs as well as detect them?
Absolutely.
That's what I assumed. Now,
yeah, I'll just address that for a moment, if I may, Dr. J.
Of course, of course.
A passive radar system doesn't use one receiver antenna. It uses at least four. And what that allows you to do, when the radio signal strikes those four different antennas at four different times, the time lapse might be only a billionth of a second between one antenna and the other, but the technology we have available to us today allows us to measure that time lag between the antennas. And what that allows us to do is triangulate, to calculate using trigonometry what the source of that reflected signal was. And then you do that 10 or 100 times a second. And by doing it multiple times very, very quickly, you can track the object and tell whether it's moving. And also you can, if the system is sophisticated enough, you can tell its velocity. And it's that velocity, that the velocity and the location of the object would tell us a great deal about what the object is. There are two separate steps in analyzing radar. The first is the detection, detecting a target. The second major step is the determination of what the target is, and that requires analysis. If it's, for example, at 35,000 feet and it's doing about 550 miles an hour, you would probably exclude that from your, if that would not, would be of any great interest to you, because that's probably United Flight 263 headed to Buffalo. But if it's miles above the surface of the Earth, and it's doing 20,000 miles an hour or 20,000 miles a minute, that would capture your attention immediately. So that's what, that gives you a little insight into yet more of the project that I've proposed in my paper, which, again, is available from our website, ufocenter.com. It's been there for 11 years.
The velocity, I think, is super important for multiple reasons. First of all, if there's a change in velocity, then obviously you know this is not a natural object. For instance, if it goes from 7,000 miles, drops down to 2,000, then maybe stops and then goes back up to 5,000 miles an hour, obviously we're dealing with something that is not a comet or something just in orbit, like an asteroid, whatever it be. And then, of course, the second part of the velocity being so important is when this object, we can track the trajectory. So not only are you able to track the direction, but based on their velocity, we can sort of see where they intend on going. Although, yes, they're constantly changing direction. So I think this whole system is really fantastic, and I really would like to see this get up and going.
Well, I'm humbled, and I'm very pleased by your comments about my proposal. Your comment about the trajectory of the detected object is also significant, because if it's doing 10 or 20 or 50,000 miles an hour, and it suddenly does a right-angle turn, and you can detect that with the system that I've proposed, then you know you're not dealing with a Boeing 777. You're not dealing with a meteor. You're not dealing with anything that we're familiar with. We have no technology that allows something to make that kind of a radical, sudden turn in its course, and that would capture your attention immediately if you're looking at it on a computer screen that is showing you detected targets.
Yes, and I am really fascinated that I'm so glad we brought this up, because as you can see from the listener questions, obviously there is great interest there. And even before we went on air, the fact that someone remembered this, the associate producer remembered this from when you talked about this on Art Bell, is a very, very big thing. And I presume that'll also be a topic when you appear on that show. Now, we have a little over 5 minutes before break, and I figure when we come back, of course, there'll be some more listener questions, maybe some call-ins as opposed to just all written. A lot of people like to write, especially those who don't have good connections. Nonetheless, we'll be getting them. But I do want to get into the sightings, so maybe we will save the best sightings for when we come back from break. But let me go to your 1990, and I believe it was 92. 1990, was it Baja, California, your another sighting that you witnessed?
Yeah. It was Friday night. It was February 2nd, 1990. A very dramatic sighting indeed. And I don't know what it was. The object I was looking at, I initially took to be a satellite, except the satellite suddenly, instantly reversed its course while I was watching it with a set of binoculars. It was so sudden a course reversal that the object flew out. As I was watching it with my Nikon binoculars, it flew out of the field of view suddenly after it had reversed its course. Then it reversed its course again and suddenly did a big X-shaped or sawtooth-shaped course across the night sky, and suddenly it accelerated and disappeared into the southeast sky. It left my heart racing, because I knew that that was not an airliner, that was not a meteor, that was not a satellite. So what was it? Well, there are very few alternatives after you've eliminated all of those possibilities. It was a very interesting sighting indeed.
Especially something that will make a right angle turn, because again, that goes against the laws of our physics. The inertia would kill you if you're going thousands of miles an hour and making a right hand turn, unless, of course, you're able to control your own gravity, which in that case, the inertia wouldn't bother you. So just that alone, witnessing something like that in the sky, we absolutely have to consider it being something that is not natural and clearly unexplainable, and would have to fit into the category of not just an unexplained flying object or unidentified flying object, but something further than that, more than likely something that is made by something that is definitely affecting our own physics. Now, you had several more sightings 2 years later in Washington State. What about those before we go into break?
I had a sighting in 1988. In fact, I think it was October, if I'm not mistaken. It might have been the 10th of October, 1988. I heard what I believe, what I assume, was a UFO, and I was seated with a friend, a young woman, who heard the same thing. And it was her immediate reaction that we had just heard something very unusual, which probably had been a UFO. I've written up this case. It's on our website, ufocenter.com, for October of 1988, I was seated in the living room of the house where I lived at the time, talking with my friend, and an object went over our house. I didn't hear it for more than, I suspect it was only 2 seconds. And it covered 160 degrees, approximately 160 degrees of arc above our head. In other words, from horizon to horizon almost in 2 seconds. And it was a very interesting sound. It was, in fact, two sounds. One very distinct, unmistakable sound was like the high-pitched whine of a hydraulic pump running at high speed, combined with a very low rumbling. I have equated the rumbling to the bubbling of a big cauldron as you render down about 6 people in it. And imagine that high-pitched whine combined with a bloop, 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 bloop as it went over your head. My friend turned to me, shocked. Her eyes were wide open. And the first words out of her mouth, and she's a ship captain. She's a very capable gal. She's not predisposed to flights of fancy. She looked at me and said, "Do you have UFOs here?" And I was totally flabbergasted by what we had just heard. And I've written that up, and it's on our website for anybody who would like to read it. I think, again, October 10th, 1988.
And then, of course, you had that sighting, and then 2 years later, you have the Baja California, and then, I believe, Washington, 1992?
I've forgotten the event in 1992, but I've had recent events in 2011, and I had a very dramatic sighting July 5th of last year, 2014, that was witnessed by, I think, 3 other people who were with me. All 3 of us, our immediate reaction was, that's not right. Whatever we saw was not a natural event, was not an aircraft. It lasted only for a few seconds, and it was an intensely bright object that, when it flew into clouds, illuminated the cloud a beautiful golden light color. It was really quite a remarkable sighting. I wrote that up. People can read it on our website, July 5th of 2014. The irony of that sighting is my cousin and his wife, who live in Albany, Oregon. That's about, I would say, about 250 miles west-southwest of where I'm located in eastern Washington state. Just seconds before my sighting up here in eastern Washington, had seen something that sounds to be, for all intents and purposes, indistinguishable from what I saw. They had a sighting down there, and you can read their report as well, which is adjacent to my report for the 5th of July, 2014.
With all your background that you've had, I think it's such a fantastic, idea, and I think it couldn't be a better situation that you are the person that is in charge of the National UFO Reporting Center, as well as created this high frequency detecting device, which I think is super fantastic. Everybody stay tuned. We are about to take our quick short break. When we come back, so much more from Peter Davenport, as well as talking about some of the greatest sightings that have been submitted to the National UFO Reporting Center. Stay tuned. We'll be right back in 3 short minutes. We are back to hour 2 of Dr. J Radio Live. Of course, I am your host, Dr. J. Co-hosting with me live in London is Johnny Webb, who will be joining us this hour. Real quick, before we return to our superstar guest, Mr. Peter Davenport, just a reminder, Tuesday, David Cerita And, of course, he would like to take your calls and questions. Do the same. If you want to write your questions as you have been, continue to do so. As long as you send them to us, we will definitely ask them to the guest as we have been. The YouTube channel has been a little slow to be caught up with the archives. Soon, you will see the Giorgio Tsoukalos video, the Jason Martell re-uploaded, as well as the latest Eric Von Däniken, Peter Levende, and Timothy Green Beckley, as well as Bob Fletcher will be joining us next week. So much more. All you have to do is go to drjradiolive.com. You'll see all the information, drjradiolive.com. That is also the same name for all social media accounts, ranging from Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, Flickr, Tumblr, YouTube, DRJ Radio Live. Again, Dr. J Radio Live. Now, before we went to break, we were speaking with so many different topics, but about 20 or so minutes before we went to break, you all heard where you can get a hold of Mr. Davenport. But I just want to iron this in to everybody out there, especially as we look forward to building this high-frequency device that can detect UFOs. And I think that's going to be such a fantastic thing when it is built, especially with the confirmation by the CIA officer. Mr. Davenport, I know you already said this before, but let's go ahead and give everybody information on where they can find you, where they can find the National UFO Reporting Center. And I know you said the phone number, but why not? Let's just go ahead and give everybody that, yeah, as well as what's new for you, any you upcoming bet. Lectures.
You bet. Our website is very easy to remember. It's just ufocenter.com. And most of all, for your co-host, Johnny, I should spell that, because we spell center a little bit differently than they do in the UK. It's just ufocenter.com, ufocenter.com. They can send me an email. I am director@ufocenter.com. And if they've had a recent sighting, and only a recent sighting, a lot of people are calling us about their sightings 20 years ago, and we're delighted to hear about them, but what we want people to do is write them down. We have a blank online report form that they can use to write up a detailed statement about their sighting and send it using that online report form. We don't have enough time in our day to listen to all of the reports going back decades, so we ask them to do that. And our hotline telephone number, we've had the same number for 41 years. Again, it's area code 206-722-3000. That's, again, area code 206-722-3000 for recent sightings.
I already received a question right now, which is exactly what I was going to ask, so I'm going to go ahead and read it. This comes from Jim in Denver. Mr. Davenport, what are some of the most recent cases that you have received in New Fork that stick out in your mind?
Yeah. Well, I've been deluged for the last 3 years. This all started in late May of 2012. The type of report that I am most interested in currently is the many, many reports we've received. I think we've posted to our website somewhere between 10,000 and 15,000 such reports just in the last 36 months alone. They are clusters of red, orange, yellow, amber, and gold lights, a cluster being anywhere from 2 to 200, I would estimate. And we are getting perhaps half a dozen such reports every day. And they have me completely mystified. I don't have any idea what these objects are. If people want to see some examples of these reports, I would direct them to a report from St. Louis, Missouri. It was the 1st of June, 2012. A police officer saw a cluster of these orange lights. That was one of the first early reports in this spate of such observations. There was a very interesting sighting on the Columbia River, not too far from Portland, just east of Portland, Oregon, on the next night, June 2nd, again, the year 2012. People can read that report as well. And I can only guess at the number of reports we've received. The reports on our website, and again, I think they're probably about 12,000 such reports, but we've taken many more reports than that because not everybody follows through with the written report, which is each and every one of those is a tragedy because people are seeing things, but they're not reporting them in written form. They're just calling. And we welcome a telephone call. We try to make them as short as we can, but a telephone call does not serve to preserve the information. The information has to be written down and hopefully reported to either the National UFO Reporting Center or an agency like MUFON. There are many others across the country and around the world. But another interesting report, this is just 2 years ago. I'm going on memory now, Dr. J, but it was, the 5th of July, 2013. So almost 2 years ago, I got a telephone call from a gentleman who described himself as a retired U.S. astronaut. He lives in Athens, Texas, which is about 70 miles southeast of Dallas. And he was standing outside with his wife that night, looking at the beautifully clear night sky. And his wife, he was facing west, she was facing east, he described to me. And his wife said, "Honey, what's this?" And he turned around to face the east just in time to see a distinctly red light pass right over his head, almost directly overhead, he said, at very high speed, very high angular velocity. And as he turned around to the west again to track it, as it continued on to the west, he heard his wife say, "Honey, here comes another one." He wheeled around suddenly and saw another one coming from the east. All told, I believe it was 6 red lights went directly over his head. And I had many conversations with this gentleman. He's a delightful fellow, very interesting conversationalist. He at one time told me, he said, "Peter, I don't know what those things were, but I can assure you that they were not manufactured on this planet." Very interesting case. Another interesting one is from the 28th of September, 2013, the city of Glendale, Arizona, which is a community on the northwest corner of Phoenix. A retired Arizona Highway Patrol officer was standing inside his house looking to the north out a plate glass window, and he saw, to his great amazement, he saw a yellow light, or perhaps more orange than yellow, but I'm going on memory, an orange light streak across the night sky in front of him, going from west to east. He was so struck by it, so shaken by it, that he raced out of his house, hoping to get a glimpse of the object as it disappeared into the eastern sky. And he was shocked to see 3 or 4 others streaking across the sky, following the same path that the first one had. All told, he saw about 150 of them that night. And if people would like to read the original report, it's a very nice report. It is the 28th of September, 2013, Glendale, Arizona. Very interesting sighting.
That is definitely a sighting that a report that I definitely have to read in full, because when there's mass objects, that definitely excites me. There was a famous case that a MUFON investigator out here investigated in Catalina a few years ago, where 160 Boy Scouts with their chauffeurs and their troop leaders, being about 200 people in total, over a course of 8 hours, saw these 3 giant black orbs, and out of them came approximately between 175 to 225, estimated about 200 objects over an 8-hour period. So anytime there's multiple objects of different shapes and sizes, I think to me that sticks out. And even if they're not different shapes and sizes, that really sticks out. I have a question that is actually, I'm going to go ahead and read it. I don't know if it's out of the order of anything, but I'm just going to go ahead and read it to do this person. Speaking of Arizona, this is actually from Kristen in Arizona, from Phoenix, Arizona. Have you asked Mr. Davenport his opinion of all the YouTube fakeries out there and how that hurts his work?
All the what? I didn't hear the...
The YouTube videos that are faked, the faked UFOs that...
Oh, yes. Yeah. I have to say, the question is a very good one, and it's one I struggle with all the time, and it addresses another related issue, and that is the number of hoaxed calls, prank calls that we receive over the hotline. It's really very, very frustrating. And it makes me wonder how many serious-minded people we have in this country still. It's really a tragedy. I would say somewhere between 20 and 50% of the telephone calls we receive over the hotline are prank calls, and not just prank calls. They more often than not come from young people, but not always. Some of those people are, I would hazard to guess, in their 30s or 40s, and they scream quadruple X-rated profanity.
That's sad.
For what reason? I have no idea.
That is really sad. It's sad to muddy the waters of such an important topic. And then on the other hand, you have to worry about disinformation coming from agencies, intelligence agencies, which I think there's a little bit of both going on. To what it... What degree, I obviously we can't confirm. That actually really saddens me that people would call and report a fake sighting and use profanity at that. What kind of sick joke is that? But nonetheless, we got an international question here. This is, I guess, more geared towards the beings themselves. This is Peter in Cambodia who, thank you, Peter. You asked a question, I remember, with Giorgio Tsoukalos. Asks, have you ever received calls regarding shadow people or anything of the like?
We've received telephone calls about alleged aliens on the ground. I don't know what a shadow person is. I apologize for that. But I will take that to mean perhaps some kind of alien creature. We have received a few calls to that extent, but I would have to say they're not only rare, they're extremely rare.
Yes, few and far in between.
Very few and far between. The problem is, oftentimes, people who make those telephone reports over our hotline do not follow up with a follow-up written report. And a lot of people, perhaps the majority of people, are satisfied just to call and chit-chatting about their sighting, but they do not follow up with a written report. Unfortunately, all of that is wasted time, because unless we get a detailed, grammatically correct, objective, factual report, there's nothing we can do. We cannot easily post a telephone conversation, and a telephone conversation just has all of the information all jumbled up into a gob. What we invite people to do, in fact, we can't do our job unless people do this, is have people sit down as soon after the sighting as they can arrange and type up a clear, factual, objective statement of what they saw, to include where they were, what the time and date were, how many people were present, what direction were they looking, what was the angle of elevation to the object measured in degrees, how big was the object relative to a star, a planet, or a full moon, or if it's a daytime sighting, we ask them to compare it to the size of the sun in the daytime sky. What were the objects doing? Were they maneuvering or stationary? All of that information we like to have in a report. But the hardest job, the hardest part of my job, is trying to get people to write. And I don't know what it is. We spend $1 trillion a year on education in this country, but trying to get a person to write is the hardest thing I've ever done in my life. It is a tragedy.
I'm really glad you brought that up because I want to reiterate that. First of all, we're living in the 21st century where everyone has the ability to type. If you don't type by 10 fingers, I know people who type with their index finger on each hand and can still type fast. So everybody out there listening, if you're going to make a report, please follow through. And just as Mr. Davenport said, unless it's written with all the proper data, we can't do as a group, as ufologists, we can't do anything with it. Specifically, the National UFO Reporting Center, they need to have those reports. So if you're going to make a phone call, as a favor to me and anybody out there listening and to Mr. Davenport, please follow through with writing that report. It may take you 10 minutes, it may take you 30 minutes, but whatever time you spend on the phone, follow through with that, because just as Peter mentioned, it is a wasted call if you are not following through with that written report that can be published and then analyzed further. We do have this is a longtime fan of yours, and I'm assuming this question he's asking might relate to maybe trigger a memory of a phone call with you. This comes from Jose in Miami, Florida. Ask Mr. Davenport if some of the calls that really stand out in his memory of all the calls he's gotten from his tenure. I can't read the last word, so I'm assuming it's tenure.
From Kenya?
Tenure. Your calls of all, it says ask him some of the calls that really stand out in his memory of all the calls he's gotten in his tenure.
Well, that takes me immediately to the Phoenix Lights case of March 13th, 1997. In fact, Art Bell and I did a long program on that date, Thursday night, and it was one of those cases that I alluded to very early in this program, where I would get a number of calls about an alleged incident. I would call Art, and he would listen to the information I had and make the decision right then and there as to whether we would do a program or not. That was one of the nights where he said, let's do it. In fact, he was receiving reports as well from the Phoenix and general Arizona area, just as I was. And we did a very, very interesting program that night. That was back when his program started at 11 p.m. Pacific, not 10 p.m. And we did a very exciting program. That was one night I remember. Another case I remember, another telephone call I remember very vividly, came in over the hotline on a Saturday. I think it was the 9th of September of the year 2000. And a guy called me from Seattle. He was a local. He and I didn't live more than a few miles apart. And the conversation went like this, and I'm going to mimic his voice. He said, Mr. Davenport, sit yourself down because I'm going to tell you a story. Well, I cringe when people tell me that, because there goes an hour of my day, and what I want them to do is not tell me the stories. I want them to write them down. Well, I'm glad I listened to this guy. He was an old-timer, and he was getting close to the end of his life, as it turned out, and he told me a story. People can read this case on our website. He did write it down, he and his wife, who helped him. It was late October, probably the third Saturday night in October of 1936. He was a man of 19 years of age. He had gone from, I believe, Iowa up to Alaska. Bear in mind, it's in the depths of the Depression. But the reason he went to Alaska is, even though humans were having a depression, the fish up in Alaska did not know that. So the fishing industry was booming in Alaska, and he reasoned that he could get a job up there, which he did. He was a carpenter and very handy with tools. Well, in the summer of 36, he went up to a little town. It's about 17 miles east, northeast of Anchorage. It's called Aklutna. And that Saturday night, he had worked, back then they worked 6 days a week. He was at a CCC camp, and they were building a dormitory for the camp. That's why he was there. He was a carpenter. Well, he and his friend, his name was Peterson, decided to once again hitchhike into Anchorage and have a night on the town. How much of a night on the town you could have in Anchorage wasn't clear, but this fellow said that if they got stranded there, which they usually did, they would go to the local jail and they would sleep on the benches in the jail. Well, they started hitchhiking from Aklutna down to Anchorage, and they were not well dressed for it. They should have had much warmer clothes on than they did. They hitchhiked or were walking, hoping to hitchhike. They walked probably several miles, and they were getting worried because no vehicle had passed them by. They were not getting a ride. Well, they looked to the southwest towards Anchorage, and they were relieved to see that a truck was approaching them, but it was a truck with one headlight that was out. But in very short order, probably within seconds, they realized it was not a truck at all. The color of the light was very strange. It was a blue-green light, and then the object flew right over them. They were so panic-stricken that the gentleman, whose name was Holger, I think, Mr. Holger, instructed his friend Peterson to dive into a snowbank to protect themselves from this very strange-looking object. In point of fact, I suspect that it may have been an abduction scenario. It's a very interesting case, and again, I'm sorry to take so much time to tell it, but it's a fascinating case, and people can read that case on our website for the month of October 1936. I think it's shown as October 26th or thereabout. I've forgotten the exact date.
Speaking of, I'm glad you actually opened the door to alien abductions, because Dr. David Jacobs was able to trace back the what he believes the furthest he could go back, and that being the 1880s. And the only reason he couldn't go further back was because of the deaths of people. So, for instance, he would go to the most senior citizens that would talk about being abducted and who have heard stories of, from their great-grandparents or grandparents that essentially talked about little beings in the room or weird lights in the sky. What's your take on abductions? Because what I'm gathering from speaking to the people who are involved, from Dr. Jacobs, Yvonne Smith, Kathleen Martin, Barbara Lamb, that they are at an increase, more so than they've been in the 60s and 70s and 80s. It just seems that more and more people are taken than ever before. And that just sort of boggles my mind, because I always thought they were going down family lines.
Yeah. Well, I don't know whether they're on the increase in numbers or not. It could just be the case that they're occurring at a steady pace and people are just more inclined to report them. So we're getting the reports, whereas in the 1800s, people wouldn't even have known how to report them. It was before airplanes, so obviously it's not something flying. But it brings to mind a lecture I gave just 2.5 weeks ago down at the McMinnville, Oregon Conference, UFO Festival. I was a speaker there. Stan Friedman was there. Kathleen Martin was there. Travis Walton, Grant Cameron was there. And in my talk, one of the subjects I talked about was an incident that was published in May of 1929. It's a book. It's entitled 7 Minutes in Eternity, and it's written by a gentleman who is a man of letters, very popular, well-recognized, well-respected author in the first half of the 20th century. His name was William Dudley Pelley, P-E-L-L-E-Y, William Dudley Pelley, very well known in his day. And he wrote this little book. I found it at a garage sale. It's almost as if I was directed to it. He describes an incident that he allegedly experienced in May of 1928 when he lived in Altadena, California. That's in the Los Angeles area, as you probably know.
Yes, by Pasadena, yes.
Altadena. And he he had rented a bungalow, and he lived in this bungalow with his dog, and he had a very regular daily schedule. He would spend most of his days writing, and then he would go to bed at a prescribed time or a traditional time. He would read in bed for some length of time, and then he would lay his reading glasses aside. He would turn off his night lamp and go to bed. Well, that's what his days were like. In May of 1928, he writes, and this incident was serialized in the American magazine, so many, many people knew about it in the late 1920s. He turned his nightlight off, and he was just going to sleep, and suddenly he found himself streaking up a tube of light. And he arrived at the end of that light, and he found himself lying on a gurney or a table in a room that had a ceiling, but the ceiling gradually tapered off to the walls. There was not a distinct, sharp break between the ceiling and the walls. He said the light appeared to come from the actual surface of the wall. There were no distinct shadows, for example. Well, it's a classic case. It appears to be a classic case of abduction. And that was, again, in May of 1928. How long the abduction phenomenon has been going on, I think, is only a guess. We can only guess at it.
Exactly. And I'm so glad you brought up that 1928 case, because honestly, the only one that I've ever heard that was documented, aside from Dr. Jacobs talking about 1880s, was a case from the 30s. Also in Southern California, I believe it was in San Bernardino, a woman named Victoria. But this is truly fascinating, because the details that this person just said in 1928 are very, very common with what's being told now and has been told for ever since abduction, the alien abduction phenomena came to be known, at least publicly, following the Betty and Barney Hill case. The fact that he was placed on a gurney, a lot of people talk about the metal tables, and then, of course, being taken in, floating through windows or into the sky, engulfed in light, is another really fascinating thing. And so I think the consistencies of that story are just really fascinating, because it just really goes in line with what everything we've heard.
Yeah. I think it invites the question. A serious investigator has to ask the question, what is the relationship between these presumed aliens? And I have to say presumed, even though I'm convinced they're visiting our planet, because we don't have proof that everybody would accept these presumed aliens and the human species. What is the relationship between them and us? How closely are they watching us? Are they monitoring everybody, for example? There have been suggestions from some abductees that they are told that these creatures who come to our planet are able to locate anybody they want with no difficulty whatsoever. That invites the question of whether they might be monitoring everybody the way the NSA does now.
That's right. And I'm glad you brought that up for multiple reasons. First of all, the NSA, after Snowden, talked about 1.4 million people being watched on a micro level on various stages of watch, was a very staggering number. And again, just us being on this phone call already has brought a lot of, I'm sure everything that we've said has been already typed up in speech recognition, cross-checked with everything else. And then on top of that, it's just a really scary thought that how many people are being watched. And then, of course, I'm really glad you actually brought the fact of the matter that the relationship, we do have to ask that question. Now, where are we going to get the answer? That's a whole separate story. But we do have to figure out, why are they watching us? What is their interaction with us? And what is their goal? And like you said, when that person told you that they can find anyone on earth. I used to think these implants that Dr. Roger Lear used to remove from people were tracking devices. But then when you hear people having these implants removed and are still being tracked, I started to realize, well, I think there must be using some other method of finding us. But again, this goes all down to speculation. Now, what do you think? Again, I'm just going to ask you this speculation question because we can't answer this. People talk about different species. They talk about the small greys. They talk about the taller ones. They talk about the insectoids. They talk about the reptilians. Did, from all the years you've been researching and all the years you've been running the reporting center, have you, what types of species have people talked to you about when that subject has come up?
Well, the one that is alluded to most frequently, of course, is the greys, and that might be a result of Whitley Strieber's first book on the subject of aliens entitled Communion that had that gray-looking face on the front of the book.
Yes, that is huge.
I guess I would want to review the cases before I really comment emphatically on it. Again, going back to my comment earlier in this program, the frequency of reports of actual creatures is relatively small. I mean, quite small. I hesitate to mention a number because once you mention a number, you're stuck with it.
Yes.
But very rarely do people report to the National UFO Reporting Center that they have seen an actual creature. There are a few distinct exceptions to that. There was a case that is posted to our website. I've forgotten the date. I think it's 10 or 20 years ago in Wenatchee, Washington, that was submitted by a friend of mine, whom I know and whom I trust implicitly, who was driving one night and he saw a creature. He asserts in his report he saw a creature standing beside the road, and he received a telepathic statement from that creature, he asserts. And so there have been a few cases, but not enough that I feel really comfortable without first reviewing the cases to talk about them. They do come in once in a while, though.
Yes. And I'm actually really glad you brought up the telepathy aspect, because that is a lot of people mention that. And one thing you also mentioned, first of all, about not bringing a number and because you're stuck with it and that we need to have more investigation. This is huge because this just shows the credibility and the reputation you have of upholding such a high standard, which is what is needed in serious ufology. We do have a caller. This could be an international Skype caller. I'm not sure. Preston Zhang, am I pronouncing it correctly? Preston?
I'm sorry, can you hear me?
Yes, we can. Welcome to the show. And do you have a question for Mr. Davenport?
No, sir, I don't have a question. I was just trying to join in on the group and listen.
Well, then just do us a favor and go ahead and mute out. And by all means, you're more than welcome to listen this way.
Okay, thank you.
Okay. Now, going back, we do have another question here. I'm just going to go ahead and read it. Sure. This is from England. It doesn't give me a name. Has he found any evidence to suggest that today's understanding of quantum physics, that UFOs may be using this technology?
Well, I don't know. I'm not really schooled in that subject. I think about it all the time. In fact, when I go out for long walks or go to exercise, swimming and so on, what I usually end up thinking about during those long periods of time is questions like gravity and dark energy, dark matter, how many dimensions there might be, and whether and at some future date, mankind will be able to jump between dimensions. But I agree with the skeptics, the UFO skeptics, who say they have to be traveling faster than the speed of light because the distances are too great. Even if they travel at close to the speed of light, it's a long trip between stars. And the distance between galaxies is, of course, many, many orders of magnitude greater still. So these are questions I think about, but I don't think I'm really qualified to comment intelligently about them, except to say that when we look at how fast technology has progressed on this planet, good heavens, just think what life was like 100 years ago. And 100 years of time is like a bat of an eye in cosmological terms. You have to realize that in the very near future, we will probably have breakthroughs. And for a civilization that may have been around for a billion years, imagine what a technology they would have that has developed over a billion years at the same rate that technology is developing on this planet. So they clearly have a grasp of physics, of their physical environment. They're able to manipulate matter, energy, and information to a degree that is vastly, vastly beyond anything we can even imagine today. So in direct response to the person's question, yes, I suspect that their manipulation of their environment is something that we cannot even imagine. It's so advanced beyond what we have here on the planet Earth today.
Johnny from London actually has got a question for you. Johnny, you ready?
Sure. Hi, Peter.
Hi, Johnny. I'm glad to have you cut in here.
Yeah, well, I was trying to get in earlier, but, you know, you've got so much to say. It's not about me. It's about what you've got to say, sir. So, but my question is, I understood that in the 80s, you were an American observer aboard a Soviet fishing vessel. Can you tell us little bit about that?
Oh, that was pretty exciting, and thank you for bringing that up, Johnny. I actually, quite by accident, did an evening program with Art on this subject. It was actually a little bit before the 80s. I can tell you the exact date that I stepped aboard that vessel, because it was a date that had been arranged between the Soviets and the State Department. It was June 30th of 1976. And at that time, I was a graduate student at the College of Fisheries in Seattle at the University of Washington. I was trying to get into med school, and one of the ways I thought I could do that was by getting a master's degree in genetics and biochemistry and apply while I was a grad student. Well, the National Marine Fisheries Service, which is a part of NOAA, the National Oceanographic and Atmospheric Administration, came to me. They knew that I spoke Russian. I had been a Russian translator for the U.S. Army in West Germany during 1970 and 71, after my training at the Defense Language Institute in Monterey, California. They came to me and they said, "Oh, Peter, do we have a trip for you?" And so I ended up being the first ever American biologist aboard a Soviet fishing vessel. And the reason I was sent out there was because of a law that was passed by the U.S. Congress. It's called the Magnuson Act, and it was named after the senior U.S. senator from the state of Washington, Warren G. Magnuson. He was the promoter of this legislation, and what that legislation did was moved our waters for commercial purposes, not military purposes. It moved American waters out from the 3-mile limit out to 200-mile limit from our shoreline. And anybody who wanted to fish in those waters in the future would have to get a fishing license from the U.S. government, and they would have to consent to allow a biological or a biology observer, a fisheries observer, aboard their vessel who would not have any enforcement authority. He would only count the fish that they were catching. So I was the first one aboard a Soviet fishing vessel under this law. I was aboard, I think, 17 or 18 days, and during the second to last day, the skipper, who was profoundly inebriated virtually the whole time I was aboard, put me under arrest and tried to force me to sign documents, which I couldn't see, it turned out, until I had agreed to sign them. So, yeah, thank you for mentioning that. That's one of the more colorful incidents in my past, Johnny. And I was quite frightened because before I went out on that ship, on the 30th of June, 1976, this is just 4 or 5 days before the U.S. bicentennial celebration. Forgive me for raising that with somebody in the U.K. I know it's... I'm speaking facetiously.
It's okay.
I know it's sometimes a little sensitive, this separation of the colonies from the crown, but the last scrap of news that I had heard before I stepped aboard that ship was something about the Israelis and hostages and Entebbe Airport in Uganda. And when they put me under arrest and threatened to shoot me and dump me overboard, I was hoping that was not one of those non-negotiable points that the Russians and Soviets were known for. I thought the world might have gone to war during my absence, and here I found myself trapped on a Soviet fishing vessel. But I did get off, and it's a long, long story about how I succeeded in getting off, but I had to use my wits to get off that ship and get off safely and alive. And I'm, for the remainder of my life, I will remain indebted to the U.S. Coast Guard for having gotten me off that ship. I got on the radio in the final analysis and put out a request that anybody get me off that ship who was nearby. And the Coast Guard did get me off that morning. So it was quite a frightening experience. And I think it may have had to do with another incident that occurred in Western Soviet Union at about the same time, or a year before I stepped aboard the boat. A group of Soviet U.S., or not U.S., a group of Soviet naval officers committed an act of what I think is called barratry. They stole a Soviet ship, a very modern Soviet ship, and they tried to get to Stockholm, Sweden with it. They were thwarted by doing so and arrested and, of course, executed.
And that could have actually led to so much more. That could have, you know, we were so close to World War III during the Cold War. I think a lot of people failed to recognize that there were so many other instances aside from the Cuban Missile Crisis, small things that literally could have triggered a much bigger response. We do have about 10 minutes left. There was one more question. I believe Johnny wrote it. I don't know if it's from an outside listener because he's been monitoring the international chats and questions. Johnny, go ahead and ask the one about CERN and dark matter that you wanted to ask.
Well, this question came from, I think it's Juan, but my Spanish is not good, but he's in Madrid in Spain. And he asked, is dark matter the glue of space, and will the CERN have a problem with this in the future? But how you make of that is up to you.
Yeah. Well, I wish I had more physics than I do. I wish I had studied cosmology as an undergraduate or grad student, but I have not. However, I will make an attempt to answer it for the gentleman, for Juan in I think you said Madrid, or certainly in Spain. I think about these matters all the time, no pun intended. Dark matter, dark energy, one of the things I wonder about is gravity. For example, is gravity a constant force, or could it be an intermittent force? And if it's an intermittent force, another question is, could there be a polarity to gravity? Could there be a polarity to dark matter or dark energy? All of these questions are very good ones. Maybe the people who deal with these questions all the time have asked them and laid them to rest already. But since I don't have the luxury of knowledge in this case, I will saunter on shamelessly in this field. But these are questions that I presume the mankind will have answered in the very near future. We have, I'm sure, some very good minds that are working on these. Stephen Hawking, perhaps one of the most prominent, but for everyone like Stephen Hawking, who is well known, I'm sure there are hundreds or thousands of other equally capable people working on these thorny problems. Once we start unraveling some of these questions and answering them, it's, I think, only the human imagination can tell us where we're going to end up, what effect that new knowledge will have on our desire to know more about the environment that we live in, whether it will allow us to travel for the first time great distances through space in very short periods of time. But I compliment the person who said, Juan, who submitted the question. I struggle with those questions all the time with respect to their pertinence to the question of UFOs. Clearly, the presumed occupants of these presumed craft we call UFOs have dealt with these very interesting questions, perhaps hundreds of millions or even billions of years in the past.
Yes. Go ahead, John.
I'm sorry, Dr. J. I did have one last question, and it was regarding something that you should know a lot about, and it was the Todd C's mangled body that was found in the trees several days after he disappeared. Could you tell us about that story? I know it's from a previous conversation, but if you don't mind going back to that.
Yeah, I see we're running out of time, so I'm going to have to be very brief on that, but it's a very interesting case. People can read the reports on our website for August 4th, 2002. A short version is a man was seen by four adult witnesses to be taken up into a saucer in the state of Pennsylvania, and his mutilated remains were found 39 and a half hours later, tragically, by his son, and the authorities have done everything in their power to try to prevent researchers from getting information about that case. Very interesting, very tragic, very frightening case. And people can read some of the reports that came to us about it. If they want my 6-page analysis, they can send me an email, director@ufocenter.com, and I'll send them back a copy of my analysis of that case.
Going back to what you said earlier about dimensions, us being able to traverse to other dimensions, I think that's very plausible because, as a matter of fact, J. Allen Hynek, when he left Project Blue Book, he assumed that these craft had to be jumping from dimension to dimension to get here, as opposed to traveling in a straight line, like you said. How can we get to other star systems when our closest one is 4 light years away, let alone the Alpha Centauri, let alone other ones that are supposedly inhabited? So I think that's a fantastic one. Now, the reason why I brought this comment up, because I wanted to bring it up when you were talking about it, is because I'm going to take the final question that I was written here, and this comes from Willie in Galveston, Texas. Since Peter Davenport was investigating cases when Project Blue Book was going on, did Peter investigate any cases that were also investigated by Blue Book with a different result?
As far as I know, I did not overlap with Blue Book. Again, I really became an active UFO investigator in the early 90s. Prior to that, I was very interested in the subject, but except for the incident at Exeter, which I did investigate, I was engaged with other things, getting an education, serving in the armed forces, and so on, until the early 90s. So I don't think I, in direct response to the question, I don't think I really overlapped with Blue Book at all. By the way, I just heard Stanton Friedman lecture in McMinnville, Oregon at the UFO conference where I was too. And he is, by my measure, he is the expert on Blue Book. One of the very interesting things he discovered was that the Air Force had a cluster of very interesting cases that were never mentioned in Blue Book. So Stan Friedman is really the person, if you have him on the program, he's the person to talk about that subject.
Yes, and actually he will be joining us again in about 6 weeks or so, and that is definitely something that we have to ask him, because we've tried to make it different each time he's come on, as opposed to the original first broadcast we did a few years back about science was wrong, and then the other one that UFOs are real. So yes, that you're absolutely right. When he was able to pinpoint all these cases that were overlooked or put in a different category in Blue Book, I think that was just them fudging the numbers, which is a really scary thought. We have about a little over 3 minutes left, so I'm going to make this real brief. I want to ask you, again, this goes back to all the sightings and all the reports you've investigated. Briefly, if there's one more that sticks out in your head in the next couple minutes, can you describe it?
Yeah, without any question. One of the most dramatic cases that I received came to me actually when I was in New Jersey. I was traveling at the time. It was April 22nd, 1998. It was a Wednesday night, about 9:20 p.m. I was serving as executor for a late aunt's estate, and I was having to go back to New Jersey frequently. But on that particular night, an object, which was described as a green light, covered about 600 miles over the state of Washington in somewhat less than 10 minutes, maybe even half that amount of time. If you do the calculation, an object covering 600 miles in 10 minutes is doing 3,000 miles an hour. However, this particular object stopped on at least two occasions, maybe more, and people can read the many reports that came in from Western Washington, from Seattle, from Yakima, from Portland, people who saw that object. And this is one of the cases that was touched on by the Peter Jennings special, two-hour special on UFOs. It was called UFOs Seen as Believing. It aired in, I think it was February of 2005, so, gee, it's hard to believe, 10 years. So people can read the many reports that came in. The reason it's significant is that object passed directly over the U.S. Navy submarine base at Bangor, Washington, and it descended and slowed and passed directly over the storage bunkers where they store what they euphemistically call special weapons, otherwise known as nuclear weapons. Very, very interesting case.
It absolutely is, and that is something that I would love to also look into deeply. Mr. Davenport, after the music, if you don't mind, stand by till we are off air so we could thank you again. I want to thank you very much for joining us. This has been a long time coming. We definitely have to have you back. There is so much more to speak about, and I hope everybody out there listening, when you do call the National UFO Reporting Center, you follow up with a written report. It is necessary. This is how the top ufologists can actually do their research. Mr. Davenport, again, like I said, it's been an honor to speak to you. If you have any final words for everybody out there listening, what would you have to say to everybody?
My message to them is similar to what you closed with. If they've ever seen a UFO at any time in their life, years or decades ago, we would like to have them write it down. Preserve the information. Don't leave this planet with that information in your head. You have to write it down. They don't have to call if it's more than a few days old. We'd prefer that they just go to our website, to our online report form, ufocenter.com, write down the details of their sighting and send it to us. We'll post it.
Exactly. And remember, everybody, this is super important, because just a phone call is not going to get posted. Again, you can go to National UFO Report Center. The website is nuforc.org. Again, nuforc.org.
Dr. J, ufocenter.com is a better address. UFOcenter.com
or newfork.org, but UFOcenter.com is much more easier to remember. Thanks again, and everybody on the team. I'm going to start from the top, of course, all the way across the pond. Johnny Webb, Danny Benton for monitoring the questions and being associate producer. Of course, we got to also thank Dave Matherly, who helps on behind the scenes, Tom Schaefer for doing the website, Keith Rowland for operating the network and Art Bell for being the inspiration. Again, this is Dr. J of Dr. J Radio Live. Be sure and check out our website, drjradiolive.com, for upcoming shows. Join us Tuesday with David Sarita Live. Be sure to check out the YouTube channel for all the archived videos of all these shows. And remember, all 200 previous shows that are yet to be uploaded will eventually be up there. And the last 8 weeks will also be there soon. So just keep to it. And remember, Twitter too. Twitter, Facebook, Instagram, all under Dr. J Radio Live. That being said, this is Dr. J signing off. Thank you.